This is the podcast of Theophilus Church. For more information, visit our website at theophiluschurch.com.
Sort of where we're at now is we started fundraising as a church, as you know, back in June. And I brought this to you as a church, and we processed this together and sort of ask God, is this something you want us to pursue, this opportunity of being at the Day Theater? And we pursued it, and this summer we just sort of went for it. And you as a church just went all out and contributed as a church, pledged about $150,000 as a church, and almost all of that has actually come in without me having to pester you. And if you haven't given yet, by the way, you should, or I will pester you. But for those that gave already, thank you. But on top of that, so our community total over the course of the last 4 months, three months, has been able to raise about $1.4 million for this project. And that's a miracle. That's a miracle, and it's God gets like all the credit for it, and it's a miracle. And all these doors have opened up. Our denomination approved the purchase. We were even given a loan that would have required us to have a certain amount of cash. And all of these green lights have happened. And we're even out of our kind of contract stage where we're sort of locked in. We are out of that. And here's where we're at. We had a council meeting this evening. So the loan that we would require requires us to have essentially about another $200,000 that we need, and we don't have that yet. And I'm just not interested as a church. I'm not interested in us leveraging our future just to have to do something. I think we're supposed to follow Jesus, and that Jesus will lead us where he wants us to go. And that sometimes is an awkward dance. Because when you follow Jesus ever one step at a time, you can't predict what's going to happen 10 steps down the road. And so where we're at here is we have been able to raise about $1.4 million. And in order to be able to move forward, we essentially need somewhere between 1.5 and 1.6 to be able to move forward. And we're not there yet. And what we're going to do is we're going to continue to go for it. And we're going to continue to pursue it and trust God. And if it doesn't happen, as we've said 1,000 times, if it doesn't happen, Jesus is Lord. And we don't serve a building here. The building should serve the ministry of the church, not the other way around. And so while we're in this process of just trusting God to move forward, we're going to continue to fundraise and still pursue this opportunity. Some of you maybe wondered if we have an answer yet. And we do have an answer. Jesus is good. And we're going to continue to take one step at a time until the doors have been fully opened up. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? Is there anybody on the council that just, did I miss anything? Did I miss anything? And you know, good, thumbs up, love it. Okay. So any questions, just really quick? No, yeah, please. That's a really good question. There was a deadline 2 weeks ago, but the debt, that sounded different. The deadline is not like, the word dead is hidden in that, and that's a scary word for me. There's no deadline. Our contract, which was our purchase sale agreement, was for 2 months, and we have gone beyond that. But that does not change the fact that we can still continue to pursue fundraising and moving towards the project. Yeah. So nothing has changed, in essence, but we are outside of the two-month period that we had originally thought that we would have all the answers that we need. Does that answer your question? Any other questions? I want to tell you how proud of you I am. Three months ago, it was really scary to come before you and present this opportunity. And what I have seen over the course of the last 3 months, is a ferocious and fierce attempt on our church's behalf to seek Jesus and be generous. And I am proud of this church. I think that you like Jesus. But may we, church, always pursue him above anything else. We pursue Jesus, no building. We pursue Jesus. Can I get an amen? Okay. We're going to read from the Bible tonight. And our dear friend, John of the Baptist type-esque man, Andy Campbell, is preaching tonight. Beard and all. John the Baptist is here. I'm really excited that he's here to preach. Let's stand for the reading of Scripture.
Today we read from John, chapter 9, verses 1 through 12. As he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" "Neither this man nor his parents sinned," said Jesus, "but this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. As long as it is day, we must do the work of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world." Having said this, he spit on the ground, made some mud with the saliva, and put it on the man's eyes. "Go," he told him, "wash in the pool of Siloam." This word means sent. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. His neighbors and those who had formerly seen him begging asked, "Isn't this the same man who used to sit and beg?" Some claimed that he was. Others said, "No, he only looks like him." But he himself insisted, "I am the man." "How then were your eyes opened?" they demanded. He replied, "The man they called Jesus made some mud and put it on my eyes. He told me to go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed, and then I could see." "Where is this man?" they asked him. "I don't know," he said. This is the word of the Lord.
Well, good evening. Had I known that I was going to be introduced as John the Baptist, I would have worn a hair shirt instead of one that buttons down the front. But I figured that you would want to know that since I'm not AJ, you could trust me. So I wore one that buttoned down the front and actually tucked it in. But I rolled my sleeves up so you can see my tattoos and know I'm also relatable and creative. So I think I've got like all of the bases covered there. So many of you, I think, know me, but there are also a lot of faces that I see who I've not had conversations with. So my name's Andy Campbell, or if you see me at George Fox University where I teach, it's Anderson Campbell. I know that's super confusing. So you may know me as one or both. You can call me really whatever you want. And I teach at George Fox University in Newburgh. So a little bit of a drive from here. I teach Christian ministries courses, biblical studies courses, that kind of stuff. And my wife, April, and I have been married for 17 years. We have two daughters, Sydney and Riley, who are 11 and 13. And we've been a part of the Theophilus community for almost 6 years now. So we kind of go back a little ways. And this is, I think, the third space that we've been in together. And this is a good time. This is our church home and our community, and we love it here. I get to preach here several times a year, and I love it. It's an honor to speak to you all. It's also terrifying because I have to see you after I preach, and you're usually pretty honest with me about how well I kind of rise to AJ's standards. For those of you who are guests here tonight hoping to see AJ, I apologize. You've seen him some. Come back and see him another time, but you get to look at my beard and my tattoos some, so maybe that'll make up for me not being AJ or being as tall as AJ. So, my mandate tonight, right, as the guest preacher is really two things. One is not to, like, say anything heretical, and the second is not to go too long. 6:15, people start getting kind of squirmy. In terms of heresy, like, one man's heresy is another man's church growth strategy, so we'll just see what we stray into, either church growth or orthodoxy. That was a lame joke. I'm just going to move on from that. I want to tell you exactly what I'm going to do tonight to kind of put you at ease. So first, I'm going to give you a little bit of information about myself in a self-deprecating manner in order to put you at ease. Check, I've done that. Next, I'm going to tell you what we're going to do. I'm doing that now, so check. Then I'm going to give you the subject and the outline of the message tonight. So the subject is Jesus' healing of a blind man in John chapter 9. We just heard that scripture read. And I want us to look at this encounter as a series of really three different encounters. There's a theological encounter that happens, there's a personal encounter that happens, and then there's a testimonial encounter that happens. All right, so I've outlined it. Scroll down here. Okay, the next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to actually preach the message that I just outlined with the right amount of biblical knowledge so that you know that I'm a professor and also the right amount of relatability that you would expect from someone who spent a lot of time in church ministry, because I got both of those things. I'll use a couple of Greek words that you don't know, but I do, and then I'll explain to you what they mean so that I can justify the student loans that I took out for all the degrees that I piled on. Then I'm going to tell you a personal story as an illustration that will connect with some of you. And then I'm also going to share sort of like a Paul Harvey, the rest of the story-esque thing that you might not know about some pop culture thing, so that you know that like I have like this broad awareness of what's going on in the world as well. Let's see. Your job is you're going to nod your head in thoughtful agreement at some times. You'll laugh at other times. You will be emotionally and spiritually moved and all in the right places. And if you're not sure like what to do when or how to react, like I've planted some people in the congregation ahead of time. So just like do what people around you are doing and it'll slip right in there. And then finally, I'm going to close in prayer. I'm going to invite us to communion together. Okay, does that sound okay? Okay, good, because we're already like doing it. So it's train's left the station. It's too late to go back now. So this story that we just heard read in John chapter 9 is like a lot of stories in John's gospel in that it has no exact parallel when we look at the other gospels. So there's four gospels, right? There's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Matthew, Mark, and Luke we call the synoptic gospels because for the most part, they tell a lot of the same stories, sometimes a different order, but they all seem to be like looking at Jesus and the ministry of Jesus in roughly the same way. A little bit different perspectives. And then you've got John's gospel, which, like, that seems like a different Jesus story altogether. There's lots of material in John's gospel that we see only there. The picture that John is painting of Jesus is just a very different kind of picture. It really kind of fleshes out for us in a new way this robust image of who Jesus is. And this particular story shows up only in John's gospel. But there are some similar stories in the Synoptic Gospels. Mark has two different stories of a blind man being healed. And so in Mark chapter 8, you've got this blind man at Bethsaida. And in that particular story, there's some similarities. Jesus uses spit and rubs it on the guy's eyes, but it's like the healing doesn't take right away. The guy's like, I can kind of see. And Jesus is like, hold on. And he spits on the guy's eyes again. He's like, now try. And the guy's like, oh, I can see now. And he's like, great, go home and don't tell anybody. So there's like no mud there. There's no like, go wash it off. So that's kind of a different story that's going on there. Similar, but different, not the same one. A couple chapters later in the Gospel of Mark, we have Jesus actually going with his disciples down to Jericho, which was kind of a little bit away from Jerusalem. So the setting is a little bit different. And there's this really kind of well-known blind beggar that would sit at the gates of the wall around Jericho. And this guy calls out. He like hears this commotion. Hears that Jesus of Nazareth has come in. He calls out to Jesus of Nazareth, would you heal me? And Jesus says, your faith has healed you. Open your eyes and see. And the guy like opens his eyes. He sees. And then he jumps up and he starts following Jesus. And he basically becomes like a disciple of Jesus. Well, that guy was super well known in Jericho. Jesus didn't touch him at all. There was no washing. So that's also a different story. This story is, it kind of like sticks out on its own. So I want us to get into the story and I want us to wonder what it was like to be there, to be this blind man, just kind of minding his own business, no idea that his life was about to radically change. And we're going to do something different for the sermon, mostly because I can, because I'm the guest guy, and maybe you guys don't have me preach again if you don't like what we do. That's all right. So what we're going to do is I want you to close your eyes right now, not figuratively, but like literally close your eyes. Good. Because I want us to get into sort of the mind, the world of the blind man. So you have your eyes closed. We're going to have the lights turned off. So turn off all the lights. That's good. And we're just going to stay here for a while in the darkness. And just like the blind man, you're going to be able to hear, but you're not going to be able to see. Okay? Mm-hmm. I wonder if this is some of the sounds that maybe the blind man would have heard, kind of part of his daily life. If we look at the setting of what was going on in this story, Jesus had just been in the temple, but this story likely doesn't take place in the temple because blind people weren't allowed in the temple most of the times. When they were allowed there, they had to meet these special conditions. Also, we know from reading John chapter 8 that Jesus had just narrowly escaped being stoned by some really angry Jewish leaders because he just kind of teetered on the edge of committing blasphemy. As we just heard, this chapter opens up with, as he went along. So we get this idea that Jesus is in motion. He and his followers are kind of in transit from the temple courts to somewhere else. It's likely that this particular encounter occurs just outside one of the gates to the temple courts, probably on the southern side of the temple, but that has to do with the pool where Jesus sends the blind man, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But I want to go ahead and get into some of these encounters as we continue to sort of sit with our eyes closed. The first encounter we have is, what I was saying, is a theological encounter. So what do we know about this blind man? Well, the first thing is that John tells us that he was blind from birth. Here's your first Greek lesson. In Greek, this word is ekgenetes. It literally means blind from the hour of his birth. And it's a word that John uses only here. It's found nowhere else in the New Testament. And John's probably using this as hyperbole to kind of make the point that at no moment in time had this guy ever seen. He didn't go blind, but he was born blind. He had always been that way. He's also tipping his hand for some kind of correlations he's going to make to this man's condition and maybe all of humanity's condition. So we know he was blind from the moment of his birth. We also know that he was a beggar. We get that a little later in the story. It's likely the only way he could survive is he would sit outside these temple gates and he would just wait for people to drop food or money into a bowl that he would have had. And then he would go home at the end of the day. This sort of was his vocation. And the community's response was to care for people who had these different disabilities, people who were orphaned, people who were widowed. This was part of the fabric of society. That's what we know about the blind man. So then you've got Jesus and his disciples that come within proximity of this guy, and then they stop and they start having this discussion about him with him sitting right there. Remember, they ask Jesus, they say, Rabbi, who was it? Who was it that sinned that caused this man to be born blind? Was it him or was it his parents? What an interesting question. We kind of assume in that a few things. One of the assumptions behind that question is that that sin was somehow the cause of this man's congenital blindness. To defend the disciples for a minute, this isn't like unusual in terms of their framework of thinking. Illness was often seen as a physical manifestation of sin. The real head scratcher here for the disciples was that he was blind from birth, literally from the moment he was born. And so they're wondering, like, Jesus, whose fault is that? If this sin is manifesting itself in blindness, which again was sort of a common paradigm of understanding sin, like, whose fault is that? Is it the blind man's? Or is it his parents? Maybe they were arguing about this, like, as they were walking by, and as they so often did, they pulled Jesus into the conversation to be the tiebreaker. They wanted Jesus to settle their dispute, be that referee. So that's one assumption, is that sin caused the guy to be blind. Another assumption inherent in this question is that the sins of one person can affect the conditions of another. This is especially true of kind of sin we see in the Bible called generational sin. In Exodus, Deuteronomy, and Leviticus, there's these passages which describe the consequences of the sins of one generation being carried out on their descendants to 3 and 4 generations later. A little strange to us, maybe, but not to the disciples. A third assumption in their question is that that an unborn child can sin. This is probably pretty extreme to most of us. Like, how would you even, like, say that it was this guy's fault that he was born blind? It was his sin. There was this rabbinic tradition, though, like Jewish teachers, that was rooted in Scripture that made it at least possible for an unborn child, a fetus, to sin. In Genesis 25:22, Jacob and Esau, it says that they were fighting against one another in the womb. This is kind of interpreted as being the beginning of their struggle against one another. And rabbis would build upon this, and they would kind of claim that this is like a normative thing that can happen, is that there can be an awareness of the fetus in the womb of what's going on in the rest of the world to some degree. And they would use this to kind of teach about like staying away from idolatry. So they would say, listen, if you are a pregnant woman and you engage in idolatry, you go into a pagan temple, that if your baby moves in the womb, that could be pagan worship. And the baby could actually be guilty of sin, of committing idolatry. Now, regardless of whether we think this is sensible, this was kind of in the minds of the disciples. They're trying to wrap their mind around, like, can we know who it was that sinned? What about, what can we know about Jesus' answer to the disciples' question? It's interesting because he kind of blows up their assumptions, right? He says, Neither this man nor his parents' sin is responsible for this guy's blindness. So Jesus is telling us, listen, not all illness is the result of sin. This wouldn't have been earth-shattering to the disciples. It's not earth-shattering to us. But what would have been difficult for them to understand is that somehow this big congenital disability is not linked to sin. That would have been different to their worldview. Jesus goes on to tell us that there's something more significant that we can learn from the man's blindness. Something more significant about Jesus, something more significant about humanity, something more significant about ourselves. He says this man wasn't born blind just so Jesus could heal him, but that there's something bigger going on here. He says that the work of God might be displayed in this man's life. It's not just a healing. But Jesus is pointing to something that's at the very core of our human struggle. What John is trying to tell us as he writes this is that, listen, just like this man was born blind from birth, so also are we all born blind from birth in a very spiritual kind of way. And that what Jesus is about to do in this man's life with a physical healing, God is at work doing on a macro scale with a spiritual healing and reconciliation. So that the work of God might be displayed in his life, Jesus wants us to know that what he's about to do is way bigger than the actual act of healing, that standing is a metaphor for something. He also says, as long as it is day, we must do the work of him who sent me. Jesus is using the word day here as a euphemism for the length of a person's life, specifically his own life. He's saying, listen, as long as I'm around with you, we got to be busy. What do we got to be busy with? We got to be busy with helping people to see, but not just physically see, but to see with the sight of God. And that it's not only Jesus that this is supposed to be done through, but his followers. He says, we must do the work of him who sent me. He is identifying himself with the community and the community with himself. He doesn't stop there. He says, but night is coming, which sounds a little Game of Thrones-esque. Night is coming. So while I am in the world, he's saying that Jesus is not always going to be physically present on earth, and so we got to, that he and his disciples need to make the most of this time. There's a sense of urgency that they have before them. And then he says something that's super interesting, but if you've grown up in the church, I think is super cliche, maybe comes across as super cliche. He says, I am the light of the world. This is actually not the first time he said this in John's gospel. It was introduced in chapter 8, and there's a whole bunch of theological debate about which came first. But he says, I am the light of the world, and there's a number of things at work here. I mean, clearly this is a metaphor that Jesus is using. He's making a statement that on its face is false, right? Jesus is not actually light. Jesus is this divine human person. So how are we and how are the disciples to make sense of this contradiction? I am the light of the world. Well, like any sort of metaphors, when we receive those, we want to ascribe truth to them. We want to give the person the benefit of the doubt that they're not trying to blatantly lie to us when they use a metaphor, that we're supposed to uncover something in that sentence. So when he says, I am the light of the world, the disciples of Jesus and we are asking the same sort of questions. Wait, in what ways is Jesus light? And to what world? What is Jesus trying to tell us here? Those are the questions that we're asking, the questions that the disciples would have been asking. So if we can get inside the disciples' heads, I think that we can then clearly maybe understand what Jesus is trying to say when he says, I am the light of the world. In a lot of the pagan religions that were practiced in this time and in this empire, light was associated with the gods or with the godly. So a man of God was often depicted as radiating light. So to claim to be light would, in some cultural senses, have had the overtones of claiming to be divine in these different pagan religious systems. But in Judaism, there's not that association. There's not this association of God being light in the Jewish concept of God. In Judaism, God created light with his first act of creation. The rest of creation was revealed in that light. Light also accompanied the appearances of God throughout the Old Testament. So if you think of like God appearing to Moses on Sinai, it was in this cloud of brilliant light. In fact, Moses, when he comes down off of the mountain, you'll remember, he had to actually put a veil over his face because his face was radiating the light of God because he'd been so changed by that encounter. We also see light as this symbol over and over throughout the Old Testament. It's a symbol for divine instruction in the Psalms. Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light to my path. It's an image of wisdom in the Proverbs. It's linked with salvation there. The Lord is my light and my salvation. The rabbis, Jesus' teaching peers of the time, they used light as a way of talking about the Torah, the law. It was given by God to enlighten all of the nations. They also used light in a messianic sense. They talked about how God's anointed one was going to come and be light to the nations. In the other Gospels, we can look at how light was used there. There's a metaphor of a lamp that's used over and over again in Mark and the other Gospels. It seems to be this metaphor for the revelation that's central to the ministry of Jesus. Just like you take a lamp into a room and it reveals what's in the room, so Jesus' ministry is this lamp into this otherwise darkened room. In the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew actually quotes Isaiah, the Old Testament prophet. He says, the people living in darkness have seen a great light. When he quotes that, he's talking about the ministry of Jesus. In Matthew chapter 5, he uses the same light of the world metaphor to refer to the followers of Jesus. Jesus says, you all are the light of the world. In Luke's gospel, at the very beginning, Simeon, this guy who served in the temple a lot, he'd received a promise from God that he would see the Lord's anointed one, the Messiah, before he died, and he holds the infant Jesus in his arms, and he quotes from Isaiah 42, calling Jesus a light for revelation to the Gentiles and for the glory to your people, Israel. Elsewhere in John's gospel, John's already given us some hints about this connection between God and Jesus and light. In that first chapter, we sometimes call that the prologue to the Gospel of John. There he calls Jesus the Word, who was with God in the beginning and through whom all things were made, sort of the agent of the Father. But he says that in the Word was life, and that life was the light of men. This revealing activity of the Father. Goes on to say that that light shone in the darkness, but darkness didn't know what to do with it. But that this light is true light. It gives light to everyone. So you see, in Judaism, light is life. Light is wisdom. Light is salvation. What about world? When Jesus says, I am the light of the world. The Greek word there, Greek lesson number 2, is cosmos. This is a deeply philosophical term. It was this sort of Greek concept of order, of totality. It means all of everything. Cosmos is the universe and everything in it, physical, philosophical, literal, world of ideas. It's everything in this beautiful unity, this beautiful union. John loves this word. He uses it 78 times in the gospel, 22 times in this letter we call 1 John. He uses it once in the letter we call 2 John, 3 times in the last book of the Bible, which we also think John wrote. John's usage of this word cosmos accounts for well over half of the occurrences of this word in the whole of the New Testament. So when Jesus asserts to be the light of the world, it's a claim to be both the law and the illumination of all that is and all that can ever be. The only way to see the world as it truly is and as it truly should be is through the illuminating light of Jesus. And for John, this light is equal to life, and darkness or unlight is equal to death. So light is more than just illumination, light is salvation. And I think all of this light talk ties in with our concept and understanding of judgment in the New Testament. Let me tell you what I mean by that. I think we wrongly superimpose our images of our American judicial system onto the concept of Jesus as a judge. And that's kind of a modern innovation. It wasn't until about the 11th century in England that we started using legal motifs to understand primarily who God is and what God's up to in the world. And ever since then, we've been kind of biased in how we think of judge and judgment as it relates to Jesus. A little bit later in this chapter, Jesus says, "For judgment I have come into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who will see become blind." So here Jesus is linking his judgment to this light, darkness, sight, blindness metaphor. So for Jesus, to judge is to see rightly, not to make a legal declaration. Think about that. If you're in a dark room, if you're trying to navigate around in it, you have almost no way to judge what is around you to make sense of it. You do your best. You can guess, try to make sense of things, but it's all just guesswork at that point. Now, if all of a sudden you have light in that room, one of two things will happen. You'll either be able to see clearly for the first time what is around you and judge rightly how to move in and about the room, or you're going to be so blinded by the light that you're more disoriented than you were before when it was dark. When I was in high school, I got to go to Space Mountain. I know it's an odd transition. There's really not a good transition into this story, but I got to go to Space Mountain, and some of you have ridden Space Mountain, and it's a roller coaster in the dark. When I was riding it, it broke down, and the train kind of got stuck on the tracks, and they had to send somebody out to fix it. And so they had to turn on the lights inside Space Mountain. And so you got to see everything. And people had two different reactions to this. Some of the people were absolutely fascinated, seeing behind the scenes how intricate the indoor ride was, how close you are to hitting your head on some of those underpasses. And other people saw the same stuff, and they were absolutely terrified, because they had in their head a good working image for how this roller coaster was making its way through space. And when they were confronted in the full light of everything with how wrong they were and how much more dangerous it was, they were terrified. They wanted to get off. I think that's the kind of judgment that Jesus is talking about when he's bringing light into dark places. In my role as a professor at George Fox, one of the things that I get the opportunity to do is travel with students who are juniors on something called Juniors Abroad, where we take students for 3 weeks to some place around the world. And this past May, I was gone for 3 weeks with students to East Africa. We traveled through Uganda, Kenya, and Tanzania. And really, we were on safari for 3 weeks. We were camping out in the bush, and we were seeing animals, beautiful animals of God's creation in their natural habitat. It was unbelievable. We spent a couple of days in Kampala in Uganda, which is a large city, and we wanted to see some of the work that a partner ministry of ours was doing with street kids in a slum in Kampala. And so we went and spent the day with some caseworkers, and one of the places that they took us to was what they called a community center in one of the slums, which is really like a 25 by 25 foot cinder block structure, and street kids would come in for lunch, and they would get a lesson in English, usually through like a Bible story or something like that. And they were learning how to read and write. It was literacy stuff. And these kids that were living on the street ranged anywhere from 4 years old to 17 years old. They lived by themselves. Many of them had either been kicked out of their house or forced to leave their homes. And they had to learn how to fend for themselves. And I've been around abject poverty before, so I kind of knew like how to process what we were seeing. But one of the students that was with me, a guy we'll call Rick, this was his first time out of the country. And he kind of knew that there was intense poverty in other places. And he kind of understood like, you know, these kids don't have anything and they live on the streets. But something happened when he was in the room with especially the really young kids, these 4 and 5 year old boys, who like while we were in front of them, they held these little disposable, they're like milk jugs, but they only hold like 2 ounces of like, it's almost like sweetened condensed milk. And they would squeeze super glue into them and then they would huff the fumes and get high off of the fumes. This is something that they would learn from older kids. And so you kind of had these like little kids that were in front of you that were getting high while you're trying to like ask them how their day's going, right? And something broke inside of Rick as we were leaving that place. And he became completely overwhelmed. And he fell down and he was crying. He couldn't catch his breath. He started hyperventilating and he was just having a full-on panic attack. And he didn't know why. Rick is a really rational guy and not very, he doesn't emote freely. And he'd never had a panic attack before. And as we kind of were processing through with him, he made the connection that like he had this head knowledge about intense poverty, but it hadn't moved into his heart. When he had an actual physical encounter with people who were in extreme poverty, something changed within him. That it no longer was this intellectual exercise of, I know this thing is out there, but it was this very internalized experiential thing. And that's where Jesus takes our story next. He'd just been having sort of like a theological conversation with the disciples about the nature of sin and Jesus's mission in the world, but he wasn't content to leave that there. I mean, I think about what it was like to be that blind man, hearing them talk about you while they're standing right there. But then Jesus heals the blind man, and I think there's some significant takeaways in his actions. First of all, we notice that Jesus takes the initiative here. In the other stories of Jesus' healing, a lot of times it seems that people ask Jesus to be healed. This blind guy is just sitting there. He wasn't seeking Jesus out. Jesus found him, and for the disciples, the man's blindness was merely a theological exercise. But Jesus was not going to leave this guy in the same condition that he found him, which is so true of our encounters with Jesus today. We'll talk about that maybe in a moment. So what does Jesus do? Jesus spits on the ground and makes mud from the spit and the dirt, and he rubs it on the man's eyes, which is an absolutely disgusting healing. Can you imagine? You've got your eyes closed, right? Can you imagine what would happen if you heard somebody like working up their spit? And they spit into the dirt, and then there's something warm and wet and gritty being rubbed on your face? That's not a good look, Jesus. So he rubs this spit mud on the guy's eyes. In the Bible, we have spit, or in the New Testament anyway, we have spit being used in 2 other healings, both of them again in Mark's gospel. One we already talked about. Jesus spits twice on a guy's eyes to heal him from blindness. In the other one, though, there's a guy that's deaf and unable to speak, and Jesus puts his finger in his ear, and then it says he spits on the man's tongue. You ever notice that detail before? Jesus spit on a guy's tongue to cure him of his inability to speak. I know what my first words to Jesus would be. Spit was a common ingredient in magic healing potions during this time. And because of that, like a lot of Jewish healing poultices and things tended to shy away from spit because it had this connotation of being like magical. Combining spit and dirt, I think, is a nod to the creation story, in which God separates land from water to make it earth. Here we have the bringing together again of land and water. Also, dirt is significant in the Bible. God created the first human from dirt. The Hebrew word for dirt is Adam, from which we get the name of the first man, Adam. Jesus is using the same basic elements to heal this man that the Father used in the act of creation. Jesus is reinforcing to us again that creation matters, our physicality matters. And the result of this healing is that the man who is never physically seen will be able to see via physical life. The metaphoric parallel here is that Jesus, the light of the world, has come into the world to cure it of its metaphoric blindness. And then he does all of this on the Sabbath, which comes back to bite him later in the chapter. Because in a very technical sense, what Jesus did qualifies as an anointing. This falls under the category of work, something prohibited on the Sabbath. But that's another sermon altogether. So then Jesus tells him, go to this pool of Siloam. This is located south of the temple wall. It was built like 700 years before the time of Jesus. And it's over and over in the Old Testament is kind of a symbol of God's blessing to the people of Israel. It's this well that's never going to run dry. It's fed by this waters from a river. So why does John put this detail in there? Well, he tells us. He wants us to know that Siloam means sent. It's because a big theme in the Gospel of John is the sentness of Jesus and the sentness of those who follow him. Jesus sends the blind man, still blind, to wash in a pool named after being sent. And it's foreshadowing for exactly what Jesus wants in response from him. In response from any of us who've gone to darkness to light. We are sent. And what's significant about the man's response to Jesus? It's his obedience. He wasn't looking for Jesus. He didn't ask for healing. He had known nothing but blindness his whole life, and presumably he'd made his peace with it. But when he had an encounter with Jesus, he did what Jesus told him to do. He washed. And the mud came off, and he could see. You can open your eyes. The first place Jesus went, the first place this man went after he was healed was he went back home. And often I think when we have an encounter with Jesus and our life is different, we feel like we're being sent to some faraway place, or maybe we're afraid we're going to be sent to some faraway place. When often the place that we actually need to go to kind of testify to what Jesus has done in our life is right back home. It's also one of the hardest places to go and testify to what God has done because those people know you. Like you know me, and if this sermon didn't work, I'll hear about it, because this is my home. So the last encounter that we have, and then I'll be done, is this testimonial encounter, where you have this interaction between the blind man, the man that was formerly blind, and the people that knew him, his family and friends back home. First of all, the people don't believe him. They don't believe that he's not blind anymore. They say, isn't that the guy that was blind? And they're like, no, it just looks like him. So the people that knew this guy best and knew him as a blind guy, they wouldn't let him not be blind because that was who he was. It was so much a part of his identity and their way that they were going to interact with him, the way that they had sort of neatly and tidily fit him into their life was as a blind guy. And now that he's not blind anymore, his identity is so shifted, they don't know what to do with that. Did you ever notice that there's this really weird encounter that Jesus has when he goes back home and he goes to Nazareth where he grew up and it says he could do no miracles there? Do you ever wonder about that? Like, does Jesus go home and it's like he crosses into like the gate and all of a sudden it's like your magical powers are gone? Like, is this still God or not, right? Let me tell you what I think. I could be totally wrong here. I think Jesus couldn't do any miracles there because no matter what Jesus did, the people would have an explanation for it because they know him. He's so familiar to them. He's like, isn't this Joseph and Mary's boy? He's not a miracle worker. He's just a dude that we know. You guys like David Blaine, you know who that is? A street magician, right? He does some really sick stuff. I was watching a special of his just a couple nights ago, and in it, he does like these little sleight of hand things and card tricks and stuff. And then he takes an ice pick and he puts the ice pick through his hand. And here's the thing is that he's actually really putting the ice pick through his hand. It's not a trick. He's really doing the thing, and the people won't believe it's not a trick. They're like, how are you doing that? He's like, yeah, I know, it looks really real, right? They're like, no, seriously, like, that's sick. That is so good. Like, that is so crazy. That's good. That's really good. He's like, I know, it looks just like it's really going through there. And then he has them grab it and, like, pull it out. And they're like, I don't understand how that's not going through your hand. Because, see, they know, they have this expectation of who he is and what he's doing. And so they're convinced that he can't actually be doing the thing that he's actually doing. I think that's why Jesus couldn't do miracles in Nazareth, because he could raise somebody from the dead. And they'd be like, that guy wasn't really dead. Like, he was just sleeping. Like, good try, Jesus. That was a nice try. I think that's what's going on with the blind man here, is that they don't have a category for him anymore. They don't know what to do with him. He was the blind guy. That fit neatly within their understanding and order of the world. And now he's not blind anymore. Have you ever wondered why you don't see miracles happening all around you? Could it be that they are, but we just have, like, different explanations for them? Have we set some things up to be mutually exclusive that maybe aren't? That maybe sometimes, like, when somebody is healed via medicine, that's still miraculous in our world, right? Maybe we don't have miracles happening is because we don't have eyes to see. Maybe we're blinded to the miraculous that happens around us all the time. When they do realize that this is the same guy, they get upset with him. They get accusatory. Did you hear that in the reading? They demand to know how this happened. Like, it's the guy's fault. How can you see now? Stop seeing. Go back to being blind, please. But if you've had an encounter with Jesus and it has changed your life and you've had to walk back into relationships as a changed person, maybe you felt that. Why are you different? I don't like this new you. Like this new person that you've become. Finally, there are, I think, some significant things in how the blind man responded to people's questions. He told his story simply and truthfully, just as he'd experienced. He said, this man they call Jesus. Like, this is not a very theologically correct answer, because we know that Jesus is fully God and fully human, right? The blind man didn't get that. But he spoke out of what he knows. He said, this man they called Jesus. I don't know. There's a guy, people talked about him as being Jesus. He spit in the dirt. He rubbed that stuff on my eyes. He told me to go wash it off. When I washed it off, I opened my eyes. I see. Like, that's what happened. He didn't have to, like, theologize about it. He didn't have to pull out the Old Testament scriptures and kind of, like, walk people through, like, the significance of this healing in his life. He just reported what Jesus had done. And then, when they asked him, like, where is the guy? Because maybe they wanted their own encounter with Jesus, or maybe they wanted to go try to, like, chase him down for being a heretic. I don't know, probably some of both. But his answer was, I think, the best answer that we can give sometimes. Where is this man? I don't know. I think often we feel like we have to justify or explain or defend our encounters with Jesus, when sometimes the best answer we can give people is, I don't know. So you have something great that's gone on in your life. You're sharing that. You're kind of being bold and sharing that with the people that are close to you. Maybe some of them don't know Jesus. They don't know God. And you get this response. Yeah, well, that's great for you. I'm great that you got that job. I'm great you got healed. But where was God when blah, blah, blah? Now you feel like you're in the hot seat, right? Oh my gosh, I got to justify God. No, you don't. God's very good at justifying God's self. You can simply say, I don't know. It doesn't have to be more complex than that. This one act of healing here in John 9, I think, is the entire Gospel of John in miniature. Humanity is blinded by sin, death, decay in all its forms, and we are mostly unaware of our blindness. But God sees that blindness and desires that we have sight. And so Jesus takes it upon himself to perform the work of healing that we need, coming to us before we can even ask. And all Jesus asks in return is for our obedience. And then when we do what Jesus asks us to do, that we will see just as he promised that we would. And the best testimony we can give to all of that is just to simply talk about what Jesus did in our life. If you ask a question you don't know the answer to, You just say, I don't know. Jesus found me. Jesus healed me. Now I see. So I'm going to invite Joe back up to lead us as we come towards communion. And if you're serving communion, you can come up as well. And I just want to close with a prayer. If you've been around here long enough, I like to use really old prayers, and this is no exception. I'm going to pray a really old prayer. This is a prayer prayed by some of the earliest Christians. This goes all the way back to the 3rd century. So would you pray with me, and then we're going to come to the communion table together. O God of light, Father of life, giver of wisdom, benefactor of our souls, who gives to the fearful who put their trust in you those things into which the angels desire to look. O sovereign Lord, who has brought us up from the depths of the darkness to light, who has given us freedom from life, who has given us life from death, and who has graciously bestowed upon us freedom from slavery. God, who has scattered the darkness of sin within us, would you now also enlighten the eyes of our understanding and sanctify us wholly in soul, body, and spirit. Amen.
You've been listening to the podcast of Theophilus Church. We hope you've been inspired and challenged by what you've heard. For more information, visit our website at theophiluschurch.com.